Thanks for listening to Matt McLaughlin History. Become a subscriber to receive exclusive bonus episodes, ad-free listening, early access to all episodes, and special member-only events. Click on the link in the show notes or visit patreon.com/mmhistory.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
A Living History production.
This is the Living History Podcast, broadcasting live across the airwaves.
Hello, everyone. Thank you for joining me. Bit of a mad scramble to get ready today. I'm joining you here from my new office setup. I hope you like it. Well set up now for doing more broadcasts, more lives just like this one. And I'm looking forward to this one. If you haven't seen our recent lives, please go and check those out because we had a couple of good ones. Recently we had, last time we had the bombing of Darwin a couple of weeks ago, which was really popular. And then before that we had Passchendaele. So please go and check those out and say hello. Feel free to log on and tell me where you're watching from, post your comments. Always love hearing from people. So thank you once again for joining me for this live. So today we're going to talk about the Battle of Krithia, a subject that's very close to my heart because I basically spent the last 2 years writing a book about it. It's a fascinating battle, one that Australians don't really know very much about at Gallipoli, and we're going to talk all about that today. So I'm very excited to share that with you. So let me know in the comments, do people know about the Battle of Krithia? Is it unknown to you? Post a comment, let me know. What your expertise is on the Battle of Krithia, because my experience is most people haven't heard of it at all. So I'm interested to see if our viewers here have known anything about it. A quick rundown on everything that I've been up to. I like to do this at the start of the lives, tell you everything we've been up to. In the touring space, a lot is going on. We're going to have our 2025 tours released very soon. So if you want to walk the battlefields, it's a fantastic opportunity. There's never really been a better time for that. It's very, very busy. Lots of people are traveling. We're carrying about more than 200 people are coming with us for Anzac Day, which is just extraordinary. I'm so grateful that people are choosing to travel with us. So we have tours to Gallipoli. We have tours to the Western Front. And our new tour for Anzac Day, which is Ypres for Anzac Day, has been very popular. The Belgian town of Ypres. Or Ypres, as it's known to local people. That's been very, very popular as well. So there's three great destinations for Anzac Day if you want to come with us in 2025. Details will be released soon. My signature tour is also going to be released very soon. So that's the only tour that I lead personally. If you want to come with me, details of that will be released very soon as well. And if you are heading over to Europe and you want to join us for a shorter tour of the battlefields, check out our website, which is battlefields.com.au. We have a range of tours we call our Explorer tours, which are 3 or 4 day tours which bolt on to your longer trip. So if you want to walk in the footsteps of the Anzacs, I'd love you to join us on a tour. We've got some incredible historians and some great tours that visit all those key Australian sites. So do come along. In terms of media things, I'll get rid of that. In terms of media things, there's a lot going on at the moment. If you enjoy our podcast, which I know lots of people do, there's several things happening. Several things occurring at the moment. So Pete and Gary's Military History, which is a podcast, really the sister podcast to everything I'm doing, check it out. Peter Hart and Gary Bain do an incredible job on their Military History podcast. It's Military History with a slightly irreverent tone. They've got a new season just starting now. They're focusing on Gallipoli, coincidentally, as well. So lots of great Gallipoli content on Pete and Gary's Military History. So check that out wherever you get your podcasts. My podcast, Living History, is back as well with a new season. Lots of great interviews. This week's episode is an interview about John F. Kennedy during the Second World War. PT-109, the Australian Coast Watcher, who rescued him when his ship was sunk in the Solomon Islands. So certainly check that out. That's the Living History podcast. And on Living History, we have a whole special, which is starting next month, on Gallipoli in the lead up to Anzac Day. So we've got lots of Gallipoli content at the moment. So in the lead up to Anzac Day, we're going to do an 8-part special on Gallipoli. I mean, it'll be the most comprehensive thing we have ever done about Gallipoli. That will be me and Peter Hart will be doing that together. So look out for that on Living History. So over 8 episodes, so that's 8 hours of content, we're going to tell the full story of Gallipoli, lots of quotes from veterans, and just reveal the disaster that was the Gallipoli campaign. So in the lead up to Anzac Day, look out for that on Living History. I'll post lots about it on social media so you won't miss out on that one. Oh, we're getting some comments coming through here. Michelle says, I didn't even know about this. It wasn't even mentioned. Yeah, that's pretty common, Michelle. Most people have not heard of Krithia when we talk about the Anzac battles. British people know about it because it's very important in the British history of Gallipoli, but Australians and New Zealanders don't know much about it at all. Michelle also says she's joining the tour in September this year, so she's looking forward to joining us in Gallipoli, which will be great. Okay. Scotty Dog, good name, Scotty, says, I was just in Alci Tepe last week. That's the town in the middle of Krithia where we're talking about now. Actually, Krithia, as it was known in the war, is now known as Alci Tepe. Didn't know too much about it before I was there. Amazing area to visit. That is very true, Scotty, and we'll be delving into that a little bit more during this. David, yes, I'm aware of it. Good. Some people have heard of it. Tribute of conversations. Hi, Matt. Walked it with your tour company in 2015 for Anzac Day. It was once in a lifetime experience where I met you and have since become great mates. That's very true. Adam Bloom, a great follower of everything we're doing. So check out Adam's podcast right there, True Blue Conversations, if you haven't already. Adam is one of our wonderful stories. A young bloke who came on the tour with us, got the bug like I did, and is now doing lots of great stuff in the military history space. So check out Adam's podcast. You'll be very glad that you did. So thanks for joining us, Adam. Thank you, everyone who's joined us. What am I up to? Yeah, so the Gallipoli special on Living History. Look out for that in the lead up to Anzac Day. 8 episodes. Books. Lots of interesting things happening. Both of my books, Walking with the Anzacs and the Cowra Breakout, are currently in bookshops. So I've currently got 2 books on the shelves, which is fantastic. Very, very grateful that my publishers have put those 2 books out at the same time. And I'm currently editing my book on Krithia, which is the point of this conversation. I know a lot about Krithia, having spent 2 years researching it. So we're going to be talking a lot about it today, but look out for that book. It is coming in July. Very exciting editing it at the moment. Also, finally, while we're talking about everything that we're doing, check out our YouTube page for our documentaries that we're currently doing. The latest one is London's Hidden War History. So go to YouTube, look up Matt McLaughlin on YouTube and find that video, London's Hidden War History. And I'm currently in the process of putting the final touches on our documentary, which should be out next week, on the Stuka dive bomber. If you're a World War II fan, I'm sure you know that aircraft. And I was fortunate to go and inspect one of the last remaining Stukas in London, which was great. So we'll be doing a documentary about that, which hopefully you'll see next week. That's pretty much everything that's going on. There's a lot going on. It's great. It's a fantastic time to be an avid student of military history. There's just so much happening. As always, if you want extra content, please do consider subscribing. We really love our subscribers. We do lots of extra content for subscribers. They get early access. They get ad-free content and special bonus episodes of everything that we're doing, videos, podcasts, everything. Also, if you're a subscriber, the Gallipoli special I mentioned, the podcast series, you can download all 8 episodes at once. So as soon as the first episode drops, all 8 will be there for you to download at once if you're a subscriber. So you don't have to wait and stretch it out over 2 months. You can download them all at once. So please do consider clicking on that link and subscribing. Well, that pretty much brings us up to speed with everything that's been going on. As I said, there's a lot going on. Just a couple more comments coming in here. Brian says, have a family member still in Krithia. Wow, that's really quite significant. As we're going to see, there are a lot of casualties here. And Jeff Neal says, I have been to Gallipoli 3 times. The last time I took myself down to Cape Helles / Krithia. Hard to believe the British command tried to advance up a gentle slope, shaped like a saucer from XWMV. XWMV are the beaches where the British landed, which we're going to talk about in more detail. Well, shall we go? Let's talk about Krithia. as I said, two Australians. If you're watching from the UK, forgive me, because I'm sure that you know the name Krithia. But in Australia and New Zealand, it's a bit of an unknown battle. And so we're going to talk about it in detail. Why don't we start? Let's do a bit of a Gallipoli backstory. Why don't we try that? I will share my screen here. That screen I will share. Okay, so I will add that to the stage. There we go. That is the screen. So, okay. So, geez, I'm using new technology here. Bear with me if things go wrong. But let's talk a little bit about why Gallipoli in the first place, because this is something I think that, you know, we know that the Anzacs are fighting at Gallipoli. And again, apologies if you're watching from Britain. This is going to be a fairly Australia-focused discussion because I am an Australian. But we'll be mentioning lots to do with the British and the French and the New Zealanders, and everyone will be involved. So it's going to be an Australian angle, but we're going to include everyone who participated. So what we're looking at here, this is a map of Europe. Obviously, you can see the UK top left and France where fighting would occur. And sort of center, you can see Turkey. So let's, if I come over here, let's zoom in a bit now. So here's Turkey. So this is Italy off to the left, Greece in the middle. Turkey off to the right. Turkey, as it's now known. I'm not sure if everyone saw about the name change that Turkey has recently undertaken, which I think is a great idea, just to avoid connotations with the slang terms for Turkey. Interestingly, the word Turkey, the bird, why is the country and the bird named after one another? Well, the bird is named after the country. The country was always called Turkey, and there was some feeling at some stage hundreds of years ago that the bird originated in the country of Turkey, which was why it was called Turkey. But the Turkish people are keen to distance themselves a little bit from the poor connotations of the word Turkey. So they've gone to the word, it's the English spelling of how they pronounce it in Turkish, which is actually Turkey. So that's fascinating. So you can see that there on the map, the new name for Turkey. So we should try from now on to refer to it in that way. Okay, I'm zooming in now. Let's talk about why this area is so important. This is an area that has been fought over for millennia. This is, when Xerxes took the Persian army and eventually fought against the Spartans at Thermopylae, he crossed the waters of the Dardanelles, right where we're talking at Gallipoli, thousands of years before the Gallipoli campaign. So why is this important? I'm not sure if you can see my mouse on this. I think you can. Ah, yes, I'm seeing a mouse here. I think you can see my mouse. So let's what we've got here is this is the Gallipoli Peninsula right in the middle where it says Çanakkale. That's the main town in the Gallipoli area. So this ocean here, this water, this sea here on the left is the Aegean. The Aegean obviously connects to the Mediterranean, which then goes through the Straits of Gibraltar and into the Atlantic and the rest of the world. So that is the Aegean Sea, very important there. And that is the Gallipoli Peninsula. I've got another comment coming in here. Let's go back to the comments. So Jats, Matt, long-time follower, just want to say thanks so much for all your great work bringing important history to life for all of us. Well, thank you, Jats. That's very kind. I do what I can. It's a funny thing. I do it because I love doing it, and I'm very fortunate that there's other people that share the passion and do it with me. So thank you for tuning in. It wouldn't be anything if people weren't watching. As I said in the first live, I'd probably still do this even if people weren't watching, but it's great to have an audience. So the Aegean Sea, as you can see there, this is the Gallipoli Peninsula. So the key to Gallipoli, the thing we most often misunderstand, is Gallipoli is not about the land. Gallipoli is about the water. And let me talk about the water. So we've got the Aegean Sea there. And let's look at some geography. Up to the top right here, that's the Black Sea. So let's zoom out even further. This is the Black Sea up here. And here, during the First World War, this area to the north of the Black Sea, this is Crimea, this is Ukraine, this is the area which horrifically is being fought over now. I can't believe a war has returned to Europe, but this is the Black Sea. During the First World War, Russia was our ally. Let me zoom out. This is all of what is Russia. Russia has ports up in the north here, but those ports get iced in during the winter. They also had the ports in the Black Sea and around Crimea. This is the only part of the Russian port system that doesn't get iced in winter. So the Black Sea is vital to the Russians and always has been. It's why they invaded Crimea in the first place. So Russia had a fleet during the First World War in the Black Sea. To get that fleet to the rest of the world, this is the path they had to take. So they had to leave the Black Sea, and they had to travel through this skinny little waterway here. So this is Istanbul, you know, during the Gallipoli campaign known as Constantinople. So they leave the Black Sea. They travel through this tiny, skinny little waterway, which is the Bosphorus River, which separates this side of Turkey, which is the Asian side, from this side, which is the European side. Turkey is the only country in the world that is on two continents, Asia on this side, Europe on this side, and it's separated by this tiny, skinny little waterway, which is called the Bosphorus, which leads through the heart of Istanbul. So if you've been to Istanbul, the beautiful river that goes through the heart is connecting the Black Sea to this sea, which is the Sea of Marmara, a big inland sea here, which is all within Turkey. So you've got the Sea of Marmara. So if you are a ship in the Black Sea and you want to get anywhere to the rest of the world, you have to come through the Bosphorus, through the Sea of Marmara, and then you go into this waterway here. This waterway is called, drumroll, the Dardanelles. That is the waterway there, and that is the Gallipoli Peninsula. So you come down through the Sea of Marmara, you go down through the Dardanelles, a very narrow passageway, which gets incredibly narrow just here. This section is called the Narrows, as it goes down here. You travel down through the Dardanelles, chug, 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 out here into the Aegean, and then the Mediterranean, and then the rest of the world. Rather long explanation, but it's crucial to what's going on here. When Turkey joined the war at the end of 1914 on the side of Germany, they closed the Dardanelles by putting mines across here, and there were large forts down both sides of the Dardanelles. The Dardanelles were closed to shipping. It meant that Russia had a fleet blockaded in the Black Sea. They couldn't get their fleet out. And also it meant that we couldn't resupply the Russians. We couldn't send supplies and ammunition and troops and food and all sorts of things we wanted to the Russians. So it was an issue. So the whole idea of the Gallipoli campaign was to seize the Dardanelles, to seize this strait and to enable ships to open this area up and to resume communication with Russia. That is the whole point of the Gallipoli campaign. A side benefit was that they felt that the Ottoman Empire, as it was at the time, was known as the sick man of Europe. And if a fleet of ships came up and started bombarding Constantinople, today's Istanbul, Turkey would pretty quickly surrender and they would knock a German enemy out of the war pretty swiftly. And that would be a great victory for the Allies. It would also open up a bit of a right hook to be able to attack Germany and Austria from the rear. That was the plan. The Gallipoli campaign. So when we think of Gallipoli, don't think about the land as much as we do. Think about the water. Everything was to do with capturing the Straits of the Dardanelles. And on the 18th of March, the British and French kicked off the first stage of this when they sent a fleet of ships up into the Dardanelles to bombard the forts on both sides of the Dardanelles and to clear the mines and to enable ships to get through. It was a disaster. We lost four ships sunk, heaps were damaged, and the Turks did a very good job of defending their homeland. Let's not forget that. We seem to have a position from a sort of a British/Australian Western perspective that we are responsible for everything that's going on. But let's not forget that at Gallipoli, the main reason we were defeated is just brilliant defense by the Turks. The Turks are incredibly brave and they made huge sacrifices to defend their homeland. So let's not forget the role of the Turks when we discuss Gallipoli. And the first stage of that was doing a brilliant job of blowing the absolute hell out of the British and French warships that sailed into this part of the Dardanelles. So with the naval attack having been a disaster, the Navy said, we're not going to try again until you silence the forts. And the way to silence the forts, you land troops, and the troops would, in theory, capture the peninsula very quickly, overtake the forts, and then the ships could clear the minefields and carry on, and the naval campaign would begin again. So that's the point of the Gallipoli campaign. In a very lengthy nutshell. It was a disaster. It was very poorly conceived. The stat that I always give is it took more than 2 years to plan D-Day in 1944. The Gallipoli campaign, which up to that time was the largest amphibious operation in history, was planned in 3 weeks. So it was never going to work. It was a ridiculous idea. And there we have it. That's the story of Gallipoli. I hope that makes sense. If you have any questions during all of this, please put them in the comments. Let's do a bit of geography of the peninsula itself in terms of the land campaign. So we've talked about the Dardanelles. So let's look at Anzac Cove. Okay. So here's the peninsula. The plan was that British and French forces would land down here, down near Sudul Bahia on the southern toe of the peninsula, and then they would march pretty swiftly northeast along the peninsula. And meanwhile, Anzac forces would land up here on this big curving beach, march inland, cut the peninsula in half. As we all know, the Anzacs landed on the wrong beach. It wasn't quite as simple as that. They landed in the area they were supposed to, but they just landed too bunched up. And they landed famously here at Anzac Cove. This is Anzac Cove, and these are the battlefields of the Anzac sector. So this tiny little strip here is Anzac Cove. Bit of a side note, this beach here to the south is Brighton Beach. And this is where most of the force was supposed to come ashore. So they were supposed to come ashore on Anzac Cove, but also on Brighton Beach. They were going to come ashore. It was actually a blessing in disguise. My opinion now is that the only reason the Anzac landing worked in any capacity is because they came ashore at Anzac Cove, because Brighton Beach was mined. It was very heavily defended by Turks. There were trenches all the back here. And this promontory is called Garba Tepe. And the Turks had lots of artillery here, and they had practiced in the months before the landings absolutely blasting this beach with shellfire. So it would have been absolute carnage if the Anzacs had come ashore there through what I would now consider a stroke of good luck, because they landed at Anzac Cove. They were effectively shielded by these two headlands at each end. So this is the only undefended part of coastline up here, and also the only bit that's shielded from view from the Turks because of the two headlands either side. So it was actually, I think, a blessing in disguise. But we're not here to talk too much about what happened at Anzac. We'll do that in a later discussion. What we're here to talk about is what happened down here, the Battle of Krithia. Now, obviously, it's a long way away. It's a very long way from Anzac Cove up here, if you can see where I'm putting my mouse, west of Kerchedere, down here to the southern toe of the peninsula. And this is why it's probably an unknown story. It's just a story Australians and New Zealanders don't know particularly well. So this is the area known as Cape Helles at the southern toe of the peninsula. So this is the area the British and French were fighting. The French landed here on the day of the landing, April 25. They landed at Kumkali in this area, but that was a diversionary attack. The French soon pulled back to Cape Helles. So this area is known as Cape Helles. And around this southern toe here were the landing beaches where the British and French came ashore. So lots of Aussies don't even know this fact, that at the same time we were landing at Anzac Cove, the British and French were coming ashore at Cape Helles. On five major beaches down here, codenamed V Beach, W Beach, X Beach, Y Beach, and S Beach. I got there in the end. And while I said that the Anzac Cove landing was fairly sheltered and the Anzacs came ashore pretty much unopposed, it was not the case at Cape Helles. The British came ashore under an absolute hail of fire. It was like scenes out of Saving Private Ryan. They were slaughtered on the beaches. And so we should not forget the huge sacrifice made by the British on the day of the landing and the French as well. Just a huge disaster, the landings. And effectively what happened is the Turks put up such a strong defense that the British found themselves hemmed in a very narrow beachhead like the Anzacs did in Anzac Cove. This town here, Alci Tepe, is what is today is known as the village of Krithia. This was Krithia at the time, today known as Alci Tepe. And just here to the right, just up in this area, in this area here, just to the northeast of the village of Krithia, today's Alci Tepe, is a hill known as Archi Baba. And that's going to feature prominently in lots of our discussions. So the basic concept, the area we're talking about is Cape Helles. The British and French are advancing in its northeast direction. Their objective, in fact, for the first day, their objective was the village of Krithia and this hill known as Archi Baba. So that's what happened. It didn't happen. They got very bogged down in the opening days and they advanced very, very slowly. And in point of fact, they never managed to capture Krithia at all during the entire campaign. But we'll get to that later on. So that's the overview of what we're talking about. So there was when we talk about the Battle of Krithia, we are talking about, I will just come back to you here so you can see me again. When we talk about the Battle of Krithia, we're actually talking about the second Battle of Krithia, which took place on the 6th to the 8th of May, 1915. There was basically in the early days of the campaign, the British advancing and the French advancing, trying to just push forward towards the village of Krithia and getting mown down. We should talk about the Turkish defense. At this stage, there were no solid trench lines in the Helles sector. The Turks were fighting from improvised positions. And so the British, there were in a bit of a bind, is that they wanted to They wanted to move forward as quickly as they could before the Turks had a chance to dig in. But the quicker they moved forward, the less chance they had to unload artillery, the less chance they had to unload shells, and so they would be less supported. So it was a juggling act to try and keep the momentum moving, but enabling themselves to build up their forces before the Turks could establish solid lines. So just bear in mind when we talk about fighting here, the Turks are not fighting from big, deep, solid trench lines across the peninsula. They're fighting from behind bushes and shrubs, gullies, ravines. There are five main ravines that cross the, or four ravines and five spurs that cross the Helles plain. So it looks pretty flat in photographs and on maps, but when you get there, it's actually spurs. Peter Hart, look up his videos describing it's like your, it's like the back of your hand, that there's ridges and then big gullies in between them. So it's terrain that's tailor-made for defense, and the Turks made great use of that. So that's where we are. After a week or so of fighting, the British have advanced forward. They're nowhere near their objective of Krithia. And so they need help. They need to get on the move again. And so basically at about this time, the decision had been made that the light horse units and the New Zealand mounted rifles that were in Egypt at the time, that these units would be transferred to Gallipoli to reinforce the Anzac position. And so General Hamilton, Sir Ian Hamilton, the overall commander of the Mediterranean Expeditionary Force, he made the decision that if these reinforcements were coming to Anzac, that he could take some of the troops who were at Anzac and send them to Cape Helles to help in the advance. So this is the story of the Second Battle of Krithia, and what, as far as the Australians and New Zealanders are concerned, was just the Battle of Krithia. So I hope that makes sense. If it doesn't, let me know. I've shot a lot of information at you. But the basic idea is the Anzacs are digging in the Anzac sector. The British and French are getting nowhere in Helles. Hamilton always viewed Helles as the main battlefield. Let's send some troops from Anzac to reinforce the British and French and to take part in the next attack. And that is why Australians and New Zealanders ended up in Cape Helles for the Battle of Krithia. Some other comments here. Kevin Morell says, the Turkish memorial to the missing, or the martyrs memorial in that area, is possibly the most impressive memorial I've seen. Very true, Kevin. It's a fantastic memorial down there. The Abaday, it's also known as. It's a wonderful memorial. And don't miss, if you go to Gallipoli, which you absolutely should, it's an absolutely brilliant place to visit. Don't miss the Turkish memorials as well as the Anzac ones, because they're absolutely stunning. Just another comment. Jeff Neal says, I've long found the book by Robin Pryor, Gallipoli, The End of the Myth, very instructive. What do you think of his work? I think Robin Pryor is one of the best Gallipoli historians we have, an absolutely fantastic historian. If you haven't seen that book by Robin, The End of the Myth, check it out. It's it casts a lot of new light on the campaign, so definitely check that out. What are we up to? Okay, so the Anzacs are being moved. I want to pause just to say what a huge risk this was. The decision was made they were going to send two brigades to Cape Helles from the Anzac sector. I won't get too bogged down on brigades and divisions and battalions, but basically there were five brigades in total in the Anzac sector. There was one New Zealand brigade and there were four Australian brigades in the Anzac sector. So two of them would be sent to Cape Helles. Just extraordinary to think that, you know, 2/5 of the entire Anzac force at Gallipoli was going to be sent to Cape Helles. And if you're a New Zealander watching this and you want to know the New Zealand story, every New Zealander at Gallipoli at that time, with the exception of the mounted units, every infantryman was sent to Cape Helles to fight at Krithia. So all of the New Zealanders fought at Krithia, with a few exceptions of some small troops. But the vast majority of the New Zealanders at Gallipoli fought in the Battle of Krithia. It's really quite extraordinary. Okay, so let's talk about Krithia. I won't just talk. I'll show you some slides as well. So this is one thing I wanted to highlight. This is a picture here that I just put up because we overlook this way too often. These are French troops at Gallipoli. We overlook the contribution of the French, quite significantly. And the French had probably the toughest part of the campaign from the Allied perspective, fighting at Gallipoli. So let's not overlook the French when we think about Gallipoli. I tell you what, the people that overlook the French more than anyone else are the French themselves. Most French people you speak to don't even know they had troops at Gallipoli, but we shouldn't make the same mistake. Let's remember the French because they played a vital role in the Gallipoli campaign. So this, let's talk about the Anzacs moving down to Cape Helles in the first place. How did they get them down there? So let's talk some numbers. By this stage, a brigade at full strength is about 4,000 men, but by this stage, so we're talking the 6th of May, so we're only talking 10 days after the landings, there'd been so much fighting going on, so many casualties, that both brigades that would be sent down were down to about 2,500. So they lost 1,500 out of their 4,000 original strength. So two brigades were going to be sent down. It was the entire New Zealand brigade and also the Australian 2nd Brigade. So about roughly 2,500 men each they had. So about 5,000 Anzacs in total were going to be sent to Cape Helles to participate in the Second Battle of Krithia. So it's an extraordinary number. Again, thinking that we don't really know much about this battle at all, 5,000 Anzacs fought in this battle. Absolutely extraordinary. This is a picture of Anzac Cove relatively early in the campaign showing everything that's going on. You can see troops on the beach. You can see the flimsy piers that they had to make. It was a terrible beachhead, terrible spot to try and act as the base for an army. But you can see lighters there that would take the men away. And the 5,000 men, the 5,000 Anzacs who would fight at Krithia were sent in boats from Anzac Cove. And it was a disaster, an absolute disaster. The boats didn't arrive on time. The beach became crowded. All of the men that were due to hop into boats ended up on the beach at the same time. Imagine if the Turks had realized and lobbed some shells over there. There were 5,000 men crammed onto the beach. Eventually, they got them loaded into boats and sent down to Helles, but it was almost a disaster. The just the movement of the men down to Cape Helles. And interestingly, when I wrote the book, this was one of the things that I think this book contributes to the history, is that when you hear about the Anzac move to Cape Helles before the Battle of Krithia, it's usually fairly superficial. Most histories just say the Anzacs moved down on the night of 5th of May, they loaded into boats and they headed down to Cape Helles. When you look into the records and see what an ordeal and a disaster it was, it's really quite extraordinary. And the Navy actually prepared a report afterwards because it was such a disaster. The Navy prepared a report talking about everything that had gone wrong. And this is a quote. This is a quote. The troops are more disorganized than they had ever been since the commencement of operations. It is not yet known whether the night on the beach had any ill effect on the readiness of the two brigades for action on arrival at Cape Helles, but the above facts are placed on record just in case it had. So interesting, I think, that the Navy is trying to cover its butt a little bit there and just saying that the disruption caused by the move may have had an effect, because basically the men had no sleep. They spent the night on the beach and then headed down to Cape Helles, where they arrived the next day. And this is where they arrived. This is V Beach. This is actually a photograph of Australians arriving at V Beach on the morning of the 6th of May, 1915, before the Cape Helles operations, before the Battle of Krithia. So that ship there in the background with the multicolored hull is the famous River Clyde. And if you've read anything about the landings at V Beach, the Helles landings, you'll know about the River Clyde. The River Clyde was an old collier, an old coal ship. And again, just the ludicrousness of the Gallipoli plan. Maybe they were inspired because Troy is not very far away from Gallipoli. Maybe they were inspired by the story of the Trojan horse, but the British got this old ship. They loaded it full of troops and they ran it aground on the beach at V Beach. And the idea was that special doors called sally ports would open in the sides. Men would rush down and overwhelm the Turks. It was an absolute disaster. The ship just chugged in very slowly. It hit the beach. The doors opened in the sides. There were men scrambling to try and build a sort of a flimsy pier out of rowboats so that men could get ashore. And then in single file, thousands of men started streaming out of these doors straight into the gun sights of the waiting Turks. And it was horrific. Hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of men were shot down as they tried to get off the River Clyde. Just absolutely horrific. And that was the V Beach landing. This was the key part of the V Beach landing. And so when the Australians arrived on the 6th of May, they pulled up alongside the River Clyde. They'd heard all these stories. They saw the bullet marks all over the ship and they saw the large graves where all the men had been buried. So it must have been quite a sight to come ashore. Wouldn't bode well for the operation, I would think, that the Australians had coming up. This is what an Australian said when he came ashore at V Beach. When I saw this place, I felt thankful that it had not been our task to land here instead of at Anzac. Here at Helles, there was a narrow beach flanked on one side by high cliffs and on the other by the fort of Sedilbahia. The top of the beach was defended by acres of barbed wire, wire about a quarter inch in diameter with a 2-inch barb every quarter of an inch along it. Barbed wire had also been fixed under the sea near the beach. Two graves in the sand, one containing officers and the other men holding more than 700 bodies, and testified to the difficulties overcome in gaining a foothold. And that was the story of V Beach. That it was absolutely horrific. So it's fascinating there that someone who landed at Anzac Cove then said how lucky he felt that he didn't have to land at Cape Helles. So again, we should readdress that thought that the Anzacs came ashore under a hail of fire at Anzac Cove. They absolutely didn't. In fact, there were only 160 Turks defending the entire Anzac sector against 3,000 Anzacs. So we pretty quickly overwhelmed them. So the real killing and dying at Gallipoli came at places like this at V Beach, which is, and we can see Australians here unloading after their journey down. So what's next?
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
David Way says, just ordered Robin Pryor's book from my local library. That's a good move, David. You'll enjoy it. Great book. Certainly one that I would absolutely recommend to everyone. So let's carry on with the story of Krithia. I've got another quote here. The thing that the Anzacs found so amazing when they arrived at Cape Helles is Cape Helles is a bit of a plain. It's quite open. It's got the ravines and a few rough features, but mostly it was open and there were flowers and wheat and all sorts of things. And this is what one Australian said. They were quite amazed compared to the cramped confines of Anzac Cove. The country at Helles was in marked contrast to the savage ravines of Anzac. It was quite pretty and open with fruit trees, olive and mulberry, elms, crops, streams, fields of poppies, lupins and daisies, old towers, cottages and wells. The roads were alive with traffic, including numbers of picturesque French and African troops, strapping Senegalese and colonial Zouaves with their broad red baggy trousers. By this stage, V Beach had been handed over to the French and was the French base of operations. That's why there were so many French troops to greet the Australians as they arrived on V Beach. So the Australians landed. They then marched inland along these tracks and through the flowers, and they set up a camp near a farm and basically waited for a couple of days. And meanwhile, on the 6th of May, the second battle of Krithia began, but the Anzacs weren't involved at this stage. We can pretty much sum up what happened in the opening day, the 6th of May of the Second Battle of Krithia. The British and French left their trenches and got absolutely slaughtered by Turks they couldn't even see. The one point that is repeated again and again in the battles of Krithia is that the troops, as they advanced, didn't even know where the Turks were shooting at them from. The Turks were so well hidden and the Turkish lines were so far away that even as the British advanced and the French advanced, they couldn't even find the Turkish trenches. Most of the fighting was being done, the defending was being done by Turkish troops in advanced posts, firing machine guns, rifles, artillery coming over. The other thing to say about the Gallipoli terrain is that Archi Baba, this hill that the British were so desperate to capture, gave the Turks a view like a panorama of the entire Allied sector. So every movement the Allies made, the Turks could see. The other thing that's so frustrating, and frustrating is a word I'll probably use a lot about this campaign, is that on day one, the 6th of May, the British and French advanced. They made a few hundred yards of ground and then they got shot to pieces. And so they dug in where they were. So they'd advanced a few hundred yards and dug a new front line. The next day, they decided the battle would go in again, the 7th of May. More British and French troops would attack. They brought new troops into the line. New troops would attack. The issue was, though, that there was now 300 yards between the old front line and the new front line. And in order to carry on the attack, the new troops have to be in the new front line. The point was, though, there were no communication trenches linking the two front lines. So the troops had to advance across the open to even get to their new front line. And most of the casualties in the fighting at Krithia occurred with troops advancing in their own rear area, effectively just trying to reach their own front line. It was absolutely disastrous and just criminal. Anyway, the battles of Krithia. So thousands of British have already been killed on the 6th of May. On the 7th of May, another attack was made across the same ground. And again, the same results. The line kept getting edged forward, but the British and French were shot down in huge numbers. Thousands had been killed in those opening 2 days of the battle. This is a photo actually taken on the 7th of May showing New Zealanders in their billet preparing for the battle. So the New Zealanders were brought into the line on the evening of the 7th of May to support the British. And on the 8th of May, the New Zealanders were sent in to attack. So 2 days of horrific fighting with thousands of casualties. The line had inched forward a few hundred yards. Now the New Zealanders were sent in to attack. And ridiculously, the New Zealanders were sent in on their own. They were the only troops that were advancing at this stage, supported a little bit by some British troops on the flanks and the French trying to advance again. But mostly it was just the New Zealanders on their own. And it was absolutely horrific. There's a place called the Daisy Patch, which is not far behind where this photo was taken. And the New Zealanders suffered horrendous casualties crossing the Daisy Patch, which was the first act of the New Zealanders. So this is the village of Krithia, showing what they were trying to capture, the ruins of the village of Krithia. And obviously, as you can see, it's been devastated by artillery fire. There wasn't very much artillery at Gallipoli, though, compared to what we would see on the Western Front, but still enough to knock a village around. This shows us the terrain that had to be crossed. So this is a photo taken from the British front line before the attack on the 8th of May. So when we talk about the Battle of Krithia from an Anzac perspective, we're talking about this ground, crossing this ground. Just have a look at how open that is. This is from the frontline trench. It's an attack in broad daylight. The attacks usually went in at 10 or 10:30 in the morning across this ground. Look how open that is. And just there on the horizon, you can see the hump of Archie Barber. I'll blow that up so you can see a little bit better. But you can just see there that the hump of Archie Barber, the hill on the background. And this is what they were trying to attack. So just a murderously exposed plane. They were always going to get shot down trying to cross this ground with the Turks up on that high ground having a full view across them. And as I said, crossing the ground just to reach their own front line. It's just quite horrific. So this is where the New Zealanders were sent in. The New Zealanders attacked on their own on the morning of the 8th of May, got shot down. Then in the afternoon, to the horror of the New Zealanders, they were ordered to go in and attack again the second time. And this time, the Australians were going to join them. So this is the battle of the afternoon of the 8th of May, where the Australians were called in to join the attack. Now, the Australians at 5 p.m., or just before 5 p.m. on the 8th of May, were digging in and they were in the rear area. They were about to eat their dinner. They were preparing their dinner. And all of a sudden, they got an order saying, you will join the attack alongside the New Zealanders at 5:30. So they had less than 35 minutes to prepare an attack. And in the official history, Charles Bean said that at no other time in the First World War were Australians ordered to attack at such short notice. But to their immense credit, they managed to get themselves organized, get into line and advance alongside the New Zealanders. When I say alongside the New Zealanders advanced a small amount and then quite sensibly went to ground. And so now the Australians were effectively advancing on their own. And this is what we talk about as the Battle of Krithia. It wasn't a battle so much as just an advance into terrible fire. And the Australians, like the New Zealanders before them, like the British before them, like the French before them, were cut down by an unseen enemy firing machine guns, shrapnel and high explosive shells and shrapnel shells and rifle fire as well. This cut the Australians down. So the Australians who remembered the advance, the survivors who remembered the advance at Krithia, talked about just the horror of, you know, the how proud they were that the Australians stood shoulder to shoulder and advanced, but just the horror of advancing into that fire. So this is a fantastic painting which shows us, shows the Australian advance on Krithia. You can see Archie Barber in the background, the shells exploding. And that man with the stick there in the foreground is actually General McKay, who would earn infamy the following year when he commanded the 5th Division at Fromelles, and McKay was blamed pretty wholeheartedly and not unreasonably for the disaster that came at Fromelles in 1916. We'll do that as another live at some stage. So that's McKay there ordering his men forward. What's actually happening here is this is a British trench called Tommy's Trench to the Australians. The Australians were advancing. All of a sudden, they came across a trench unexpectedly full of British troops, and this was the new front line. The Australians hadn't realised that they hadn't reached the front line yet. So they sort of scrambled across Tommy's Trench and began continued the advance towards Krithia and Archie Barber. And it was just a disaster. Charles Bean, the war correspondent who went on to write the official history and also to found the Australian War Memorial, he was there at this battle. He watched it firsthand. He actually went forwards and back several times across the battlefield, half a dozen times. He said he knew this battle better than any other one of the war, with the exception of Pozieres in France, which he also crossed a lot. And in fact, he rescued a wounded man and was recommended for the Military Cross, which he didn't receive because he was actually a civilian, so he was not entitled to a military award. But here's a quote from Charles Bean as the Australians left Tommy's Trench in that painting, the moment when the Australians climbed up out of the trench and continued the advance. I had watched from the Tommy's Trench line after line of men scramble to the parapet, stand there for a moment astride of the trench with rifle and bayonet clutched across their chests, glaring to the front with eyes puckered to pick up any trace of where the tempest of bullets came from. I noted in my diary, their faces were set, their eyebrows bent. They looked into it for a moment as men would look into a dazzling flame. I never saw so many determined faces at once. Bean certainly loved the Anzacs. And that's a wonderful quote about it. As a slight aside, there's also something quite interesting that happened here. Bean described in the official history in his diary and pretty much for the rest of his life, he talked about a sterling scene that he saw. He saw a young bloke advancing with a shovel held in front of his face, in the words of Bean, as someone would hold an umbrella against the rain. And that just shows the hail of fire. Just imagine, I mean, war is all about human response. Just imagine that poor young bloke. He's advancing. There's so many bullets flying at him. It's like he's walking into a hailstorm. He's holding up a shovel in front of his face, which obviously isn't going to provide any protection against bullets, but it's just a human instinct to just try and protect yourself in whatever way you could. So that just shows the weight of the fire that was coming at the Australians. Just absolutely horrific, and men were falling all over the place. The Australians advanced 300 or 400 yards, not very far. Hundreds and hundreds and hundreds were cut down. Thousands, in fact, were cut down in this advance. It was one of the most futile and costly advances Australians would participate in during the war. And this is a photo that was taken at the end of the day from the new front line where the Australians dug in. So this is actually looking back towards the British sector from the new front line. And this just shows Australian bodies lying out in no man's land. What a photo. There's a rifle there. There's 3 or 4 bodies we can see, just men just hit everywhere. And fell and lay there. And interestingly, Charles Bean came back to Krithia. He came back to Gallipoli at the start of 1919. And he went to Krithia and he walked the ground, and the bodies of the Australians, the skeletons, were still lying out on the battlefield where they'd been left. They'd never been buried. And they were still lying there. And he collected several scraps of uniform and remnants of the Australians, of the men that had been killed. And they're still in the Australian War Memorial collection. I've been fortunate to see them. I'm not sure if there's any on display. Occasionally they have them on display. But I've seen them in the vaults of the Australian War Memorial, and like tattered scraps of uniform with the Australia symbol and colour patch of the battalions that participated. So, incidentally, this was a almost wholly Victorian action. The 2nd Brigade had been raised in Victoria. So for our friends who are watching from Victoria, it is almost a wholly Victorian action. So you should be very proud of the work that the Victorians did here. We've got a question here from JLennox12. Matt, you say common comment that the Turks were not visible. There were some fights over territory where the trenches disguised covered with logs. Oh, okay. So were the trenches disguised covered with logs? Jeff asks. No, Jeff, basically the Turks had not had a chance to establish trenches yet. This was only 10 days after the landing. There were some trenches starting to be formed. But the Turks are mostly just hidden in ravines, hidden behind clumps of scrub, hidden in little short scrapes or sections of trench. And it was just the distance involved. Men were advancing, couldn't see where the fire was coming from. The Turks were very well concealed just in natural features of the ground. And basically, it's a factor of the simple fact that the Anzacs didn't get close to them. They couldn't see, the British and French didn't either. The reason they couldn't see the Turks is they never got within more than a few hundred yards of them. And so that's why it was so difficult to see where the fire was coming from. But again, imagine the horror of that situation of advancing and not even knowing where the fire is coming from, and coming from all directions as well. So another comment here, Tamara says, incredibly proud of family members in both the 6th and 7th battalions. Well, Tamara, the 6th and 7th were right in the thick of the action. So 5th, 6th, 7th and 8th battalions advanced at Krithia. So most soldiers identified most closely with their battalion. So if we talk about family members now that we know who served during the war, usually it's a battalion that we associate with them. A battalion's about 1,000 men at full strength. And so the 4 battalions that participated from the Australian perspective were the 5th, 6th, 7th and 8th. So if you have a relative who was at Gallipoli in that time, they almost certainly participated in the horrendous Battle of Krithia. So just look at that photo. To me, that's one of the most moving photos of the war, just showing Australians lying out there and knowing that most of those Australians would still be there when Charles Bean came back 4 years later. Just terrific. Incidentally, in about 2013, I think it was, 2014, we had a tour at Gallipoli for Anzac Day, and I was not leading the tour, but I happened to be in Gallipoli at the same time. I caught up with the group, and one of the passengers said, oh, we were at Cape Helles today walking the ground, and we walked across the battlefield of Krithia that I'd never heard of. Oh, and I found this. I thought this was interesting, and he held out his hand, and he had an Australian Rising Sun collar dog. Actually, it was a collar dog, not a shoulder title. It was a collar dog from the collar of an Australian soldier. It was a little bit bent up and obviously very rusty, but that almost certainly came from an Australian killed in that advance at Krithia. Absolutely unbelievable. It was the only time in the Gallipoli campaign that the Australians were there, just for this one day. And so he found an Australian Rising Sun badge on the battlefield of Krithia. Just extraordinary. I'm very jealous. I wish it had been me that had found it, but amazing that these things are still there to be found. Absolutely extraordinary. So, I mean, I haven't done a particularly detailed battle analysis here, basically because there's not much to discuss. The Australians advanced, they got mown down, and it was horrific, but I do have some accounts here to describe just how horrific it was. This is a New Zealander, actually. I'd covered about 75 yards at my top speed when by a hammer, and I fell over and lay still among the daisies. This is a New Zealander crossing the daisy patch. After a few seconds, perceiving that I was not dead, but had merely been shot through both legs. Extraordinary. I raised my head cautiously and looked about me. The ground all around me was plentifully dotted with khaki-clad figures, for the most part ominously still, though here and there was to be seen one endeavouring to crawl to the trenches in front. Just in front lay the British trench, and as I looked, one of the men in it beckoned to me with his finger. I made ready to act on it by unfastening my equipment and allowing it to fall off. As I was unable to get up, I had no alternative but to shuffle along as best I could. By using this mode of progression, I reached the trench and lay there in great pain, but sheltered from the constant stream of bullets. And again, that emphasizes the point I made before. This, most of the casualties occurred in the advance to the front line. This was not a heroic advance to capture enemy trenches. They never got anywhere near the enemy trenches. This was an advance to the front line. Horrific. Absolutely horrific. This is another quote about what it was like to try and advance in this area. Now the storm was let loose and increased every moment in fury until a splashing, spurting shower of lead was falling like rain on a pond. Hugging the ground in frantic terror, we began to dig blindly with our puny entrenching tools, but soon the 4 men nearest me were lying, one dead, 2 with broken legs and the other badly wounded in the shoulder. A sledgehammer blow on the foot made me turn with positive relief that I had met my fate, but it was a mere graze and hardly bled. Another bullet passed through my coat and a 3rd ripped along 2 feet of my rifle sling. Then the wounded man on my right got a bullet through the head that ended his troubles. And still without remission, the air was full of hissing bullets and screaming shells. What can I say about that? It's just horrific. As I said, this wasn't a battle. This was a slaughter. It only lasted about an hour as well, I should add. This was the Australians and New Zealanders advanced. They got mown down. They dug in where they were. Another quote, you could see your mates going down right and left, and you were face to face with the stark realization that this was the end of it. And that was the thought that was with you the whole time, because despite the fact that we couldn't see a Turk, he was pelting us with everything he got from all corners. And the marvel to me is how the dickens he was able to do it after the barrage that had fallen on him. And sure enough, we got to within about a mile of Krithia village when I copped my packet. And as I lay down, I said, thank Christ for that. That was actually Private Brent, his name was, and he was wounded so badly at Krithia that he was sent back to England and never returned to Gallipoli. But then he returned to the Western Front and earned himself a Distinguished Conduct Medal fighting on the Western Front. So very brave man, but I just love that. When we got half a mile with Krithia Village, when I copped my packet, very badly wounded he was, but he survived the war. And I thought I'd show you this just to demonstrate what was achieved at the Battle of Krithia. So I'll blow that up full screen. I'll enlarge on my own screen so I can see. Okay, so this is a map of the southern toe of Cape Helles. Don't worry about reading all the footnotes. I'll talk you through it. Basically, it's pretty straightforward. Where it says 29, that's the British 29th Division that the Australians were attached to. On the right, the CEO, that's the French, the Corps Expeditionary Orient. The Australians and New Zealanders were loosely in the middle, where it says Krithia Spur and Fir Tree Spur. That's where the Australians and New Zealanders were advancing, on the left of that road that runs up through the sort of middle of the battlefield and leads all the way from V Beach at the bottom all the way up to the top right to the village of Krithia. Okay. The dotted line closest to Krithia, that's the objective. That is where they were supposed to advance from. The solid black line, the furthest away from that to the southwest, was where they started from. So that was the advance. This was the first objective, not even the final objective. This was the first objective on the 6th of May, was to take that dotted line and from there then push on and capture Krithia. So bear that in mind. The battle went for 3 days, the 6th to the 8th of May. The first objective on the 6th of May is that dotted line, not very close to Krithia. Here's what actually happened. Each of those lines in between the solid black line and the dotted line show the advance each day. So the British got to that first dotted line on the 6th of May. On the 7th of May, they got to that next bottom line. And then when the Australians and New Zealanders came in and the French on the right, they managed to advance that dotted line with the three dots, that third one. They never got anywhere near their objective for the first day of the battle, the 6th of May. And in point of fact, I'll reveal the big fact now. The village of Krithia was never taken by the British and the Allies, even though it was their objective for the first day of the campaign. So the British and French were at Gallipoli for 9 months. They were there for a month longer than the Australians. They were there for 9 months and they lost between them 30,000 men killed or wounded. No, sorry, 30,000 killed they lost, not wounded. Add another 100,000 wounded. 30,000 killed they lost and were still nearly 2 kilometres short of their objective for the first day of the campaign. There is nothing that sums up how terrible the Gallipoli campaign was than that statistic. It's just horrific. If anyone says to me, explain in one simple fact why Gallipoli was such a disaster, that's it. That's the Second Battle of Krithia. Horrific. Any questions? If you've got questions, please put those in the comments. If you're watching this after the fact, because we get thousands of people watch these videos once they're uploaded to YouTube, if you're watching this after the fact, please put your questions in the comments and I will respond to them when they pop up. But if you're watching this live and you've got any questions about that battle at all, please put them in the comments. It's not really much to say, just horrific loss of life. Let's talk about the casualties. So we had about 2,500 men in each brigade, so 5,000 in total. We lost about 50% of the men that went into action in the Battle of Krithia. So just under 50% of the New Zealanders and almost exactly 50% with the Australians killed or wounded. It was absolutely horrific. It destroyed the two brigades that participated. So when the New Zealand and Australian brigades went back to Anzac, and obviously they continued fighting at Anzac for the rest of the campaign, it took them several months before they were up to strength enough to participate in operations that came up. But we'll talk about those in a bit more detail. So we've got a question here. What should happen to human remains found on the peninsula? We found plenty scattered around Hill 60 at Anzac. Thoughts on a possible mass grave in the area? Interesting question, Kevin. Human remains at Gallipoli, you find them a lot, particularly in the Anzac sector, because, as Les Carline said, the Anzac sector is basically an erosion in progress. So the Anzac sector is constantly, as it rains, the land is constantly washing down into the sea, and so it uncovers human remains. Most of those generally are Turkish, and the reason I say that is because the Turks were not as focused on burial as the Allies were, and so the Turks. One quote I saw said that the Turks just used to cover their bodies with enough dirt to stop their coats blowing in the breeze. So the Turks are always a bit more ambivalent about their dead on the battlefield. They'd just cover them up. They'd throw them into the nearest gully. They'd throw them into an abandoned trench and cover them up. So often when you find human remains, which pretty much everyone does when they go to Gallipoli, the probably safest bet is that they're Turkish. The Turks have actually done a great job of identifying their own mass graves at Gallipoli in recent decades, which is great to see. Occasionally you can find human remains in an area that you suspect might be an Anzac or a British or French remains down in the Hellas sector. And usually that doesn't indicate anything except it's just a body that was either in a shallow grave and was never discovered or still lying out there after the war. Most of the bodies were collected after the war and put in cemeteries, but occasionally some were missed in shallow graves and they've just been exposed by the weather. So I found numerous human remains when I've been at Gallipoli. It depends what they are. If it's just a single bone, usually not much happens with it. Usually you just sort of rebury it and leave it there. But if it's a skull or, I mean, this is pretty gory, I'm sorry, but if it's a skull or sort of a whole skeleton, then Commonwealth War Graves will come and reinter that as an unknown soldier. So it's a big question about human remains. It's always a question. Kevin's just clarifying at Krithia what should happen with human remains. Oh, okay. I think Kevin's alluding to the thoughts about a mass grave. This is an aside, but we should talk about it. So Lambis and Glazos, who discovered the mass graves at Fromelles, is convinced that there's a mass grave at Krithia, containing Australians. And he's currently doing hard work trying to prove that there's a grave or several mass graves at Krithia where the Australians were buried. Probably either immediately in the days after the battle, they were buried in mass graves, or even after the war, when graves units came through, they might have been put in mass graves. Personally, I think it's unlikely, because we're going to talk in a minute about the main cemetery that is at Krithia. I think the Australians that were killed at Krithia are all buried there. And we'll talk about that a little bit later on. I just don't think the maths works particularly well. But Lambis is very determined and he is convinced there's a mass grave. So we'll see what happens. And I'm happy to be proven wrong on that one, because I think it would be quite remarkable if we discovered a mass grave at Krithia containing the missing Australians. So I hope that answers your question, Kevin. We'll wait. The jury's still out. We'll wait to see. Let's talk about Krithia today. Let's just look at a few photos. Normally on these things, I do a video. I don't actually have a video of the Krithia area, but I do have some photos. So let's talk about those. So this, I'll blow this up full screen for you so you can see. So this is V Beach, where the British came ashore on the day of the landing on the River Clyde and were mown down. That little spit of rocks there in the foreground was where the River Clyde ran aground. And so this was the hell that was V Beach. I'm not sure the numbers. I think about 1,000 men were supposed to come ashore, and I think 200 managed to get ashore safely. You can just see to the right where that boat is sort of lying there. There's a low bank, and that bank was there on the day of the landing. And that's what saved hundreds of men, because they could shelter behind that bank and couldn't get shot by the Turks. Off to the sort of center right is a white, you can see also a white shape. That's the cemetery at V Beach, which contains thousands of bodies of the men killed in the sector. And up on the cliffs to the right in the center of the picture there, you can see that memorial. That's the Cape Helles Memorial, the Helles Memorial, which we're going to talk about in a bit more detail. This is the Helles Memorial. This records the missing from Cape Helles, mostly British, about 20,000 British missing from Cape Helles. But interestingly, there are some Australians recorded here. The Australian missing from the Battle of Krithia. So 230 odd men, their bodies were never recovered of the probably nearly 2,000 Australians killed or wounded. About 230 odd were not recovered, and they are recorded on the Helles Memorial, the missing of Krithia. And that's just a photograph there showing that the Australians that's a tribute to the Anzac Corps, because this is also a battle memorial. But the Australian names are on that memorial as well, alongside about 20,000 of their missing British comrades. The New Zealanders are not on this memorial. As always, the New Zealanders are determined to upset British British order. And so the New Zealanders are listed on a memorial close to the battlefield at 12 Tree Copse Cemetery. That's where you have to go to see the New Zealand missing. It's funny, though, in my research, I found quite a few New Zealanders who there'd been some administrative confusion about when they'd been killed. And they're only on the memorial at 12 Tree Copse if they were killed at Krithia. But there were some admin problems and some people were listed as having been killed later. So they're actually recorded on the memorial at Chunuk Bear in the Anzac sector, even though they were killed at Gallipoli. So if you are looking for a relative or a New Zealander who was killed, you might actually find them remembered in the Anzac sector rather than at Cape Helles where they belong. this is the battlefield today. We saw those photos taken at the time, and this is the same view today, looking across the battlefield. This is the killing fields of Krithia. This is about the position of the Anzac line. It's a little bit further back. This was probably the start line on the 6th of May where the British advanced from. But you can see, again, on the skyline, you can see the hump of Archie Baba. The important thing to note is today the ground is a lot more farmed and cultivated than it was in 1915. So we saw how open and barren the plain was in 1915. Today there's a lot more trees and crops and things going on. So it's not as easy to picture what it was like. But in 1915 it was completely barren. But as you can see, it's still a fairly open plain, and it's an absolutely wonderful battlefield to walk across. I'd list it as one of my top three, I would say, battlefields that you absolutely must walk across if you want to walk in the footsteps of the Anzacs. Other ones are like, I would say, Bullecourt in France is a wonderful battlefield to walk across. Hamel from a 1918 battlefield, the battlefield is great. The approach is great, just to get a feeling for what the Anzacs went through, but add Krithia to that list. You can walk in the footsteps of the Anzacs from the moment they stepped ashore at V Beach all the way up to Redoubt Cemetery, where the dead now lie. It's an extraordinary battlefield, and I've done it several times, so please do that when you go to Gallipoli. In the future, at some stage, I'm not sure if it'll be in 2025 or later, but I will do a signature tour to Gallipoli, where I will lead a tour to walk this ground, and we will absolutely, as a highlight, we will walk the full battlefield of Krithia. So look out for that. I'll advise when that's available. This is where the battle ended for the Australians. This is Redoubt Cemetery. There's several thousand burials here, and about 1,300 of them are unidentified. I think there's about just under 2,000 buried there, roughly, and about 1,300 are unidentified. And so there's another perspective here of the cemetery. Like all Gallipoli cemeteries, it's quite extraordinary. There's no headstones marking unknown graves. So the whole cemetery is full of bodies, all buried in neat graves and neat rows, but they're just not marked with headstones. So people often walk around that grass area thinking, oh, we're just in a, you know, a park in the middle of the cemetery. It's not. It's there's bodies underneath your feet. 1,300 of them in this cemetery. Going back to the mass grave, I think because of the maths, because of the number of unknowns buried there, I think it's highly likely that that the Australians who were buried in mass graves after the fighting were reburied in Redoubt Cemetery. But again, I'm happy to be proven wrong if Lambus discovers that that's not the case. Let's go to a couple of comments. So we've got here. So Tamara says, one of my family members is one of the missing, and his name is on the memorial. Well done. Well done to that man. Good on him. That's a shame we can't remember him at a grave, but he's there alongside his mates and alongside the Brits as well. Let's not forget them. David says, thank you, Matt, for this presentation. Very welcome, David. I was blessed to tour the peninsula with your tour led by Craig Roach in 2022. We found remains which were GPS'd and reported by Craig to CWGC, the Commonwealth War Graves Commission. Wow, quite extraordinary. If Craig is noting that they should be reported to the Commonwealth War Graves, Craig, who lives at Gallipoli, that means it must have been pretty significant remains. So I'm sure the Commonwealth War Graves has taken those in hand and reburied them. So this is Redoubt Cemetery, the end of the journey. This is where the Australians who were killed at Krithia lie. This is just behind the furthest point reached by the Australians in the advance. It's a long way from Krithia to this spot, the village of Krithia. So they didn't get very close, but they're all buried here. Interestingly, there's an English oak tree in this cemetery as well, the only one on the peninsula, and it's a memorial to a British soldier who was killed in a diversionary attack in August in the Helles sector. So there was a third battle of Krithia, I'm sorry to say. The lessons weren't learnt from the first or second. The third battle of Krithia took place in June, July. There's a number of attacks there. This time the British did get into the Turkish trenches, but were repulsed with heavy loss. So again, lots of casualties and no gaining of ground. And again, when the British left in January 1916, when they withdrew from Gallipoli, they were still 2 kilometres short of the village of Krithia, their objective for the first day. They never captured it. One of my favourite headstones, when I say favourite, one of the headstones that touches me the most at Gallipoli is in this cemetery. It's a bloke called Archie Odgers, who actually fought under the pseudonym Mark Wraith. I don't know why, but he fought under a false name. But he's buried in the cemetery, and he actually has a known grave, which is unusual. So he was identified He was killed in the Battle of Krithia. And his headstone says, still living, still loving, still with us. And I think that's a wonderful wonderful summation of what happened at Krithia. And that's actually the last line in my book, as I say, the people at Krithia are still with us, if only we make the effort to look for them. So that's really quite extraordinary. Well, I hope that whet your appetite a bit to get over to Gallipoli. I'm getting excited when I see the terrain now. I just get so excited. It is a wonderful battlefield, the most wonderful battlefield I think you can visit. So if you haven't been, get over there. It is absolutely fantastic. Come with us on a tour or simply head over there yourself and check it out. It's a fantastic battlefield. But thank you so much for joining me. I really appreciate it. This is the shameless plug section. There's the book, the Krithia book, which has been a labor of love for 2 years now, is coming out in July. So you can pre-order it online now. So please do. I'm very proud of it. It was a great story, and I feel very honored that I got to tell it. These men deserve to be remembered. As we said with Archie Odgers, he's still loving, still living, still with us. And I think that's very true. So thank you very much for joining me for this live. We had a great turnout. So thank you for tuning in. We'll do another one in the not too distant future. But just thank you so much for joining me, and I will see you out there for another interesting chapter of history. Thanks very much.
Thanks for listening. Don't forget to subscribe and leave a review for the podcast, and visit livinghistorytv.com for more great history content.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
It's the question that's on everyone's mind. How do you live a good life? Is it about work, health, or relationships? What about happiness, meaning, and money? What really matters? And how can you dramatically improve all of these things? These are the questions we explore every week on the top-ranked podcast, Good Life Project, hosted by award-winning author and perpetual seeker Jonathan Fields, which also happens to be me. Every week, I sit down with world-renowned researchers, experts, and scions of art and industry on the Good Life Project podcast. This week, in fact, we're sharing a fantastic conversation with the author Elizabeth Gilbert about a single practice that changed her life. Listen to the Good Life Project podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.